You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Negebauer.
Welcome to the podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Negebauer, and today is February 23rd. We've got a really exciting podcast coming up. We are doing a special double feature all about captivity issues. So today we have Anna Gullickson and Howard Garrett. Anna Gullickson is a float plane pilot, and she is working on a bill in Washington state that would ban cetaceans in captivity. And Howard Garrett, of course, is from Orca Network, and he is going to be on talking about NOAA's recent decision to include the captive killer whale Lolita as a member of the Southern Resident Killer Whales, giving her endangered status. So we're going to talk about some of the implications of that decision with Howard. And first up, though, I want to go over some news because there's a lot happening right now. A lot of good news. We know that J50 is was born in actually at the very, very end of last year. And we know now that she is a girl, and there is still a little bit of speculation going on about who the mommy is, but in recent observations, she's been traveling almost exclusively with J16, which is the older of the two mommies we were looking at. And another surprise, J51, another new baby, was born. And this baby, we still don't know the sex, but we do know that it's been swimming with J19 Saatchi. And so that's really exciting to see that we have two new babies in J-Pod. And there was a satellite tag on J27 Blackberry. And it's been interesting watching some of their travels. And it's kind of interesting, too, that both of these calves were born during the time that the satellite tag was on him. Recently, though, that satellite tag has fallen off, and we know this because it stopped beeping, basically. When the tag reaches the surface, it can send a little ping out to a satellite. But it was helpful while it was on. The NOAA research crews went out of Newport, Oregon, the Bell M. Shimada. And on board, there are researchers with all sorts of instruments, small boats to deploy. And the tag on J-27 led them right to their location, of course, up in the San Juan Islands in the inland waters. And it was kind of, at first, I was a bit suspicious of this move because I was like, hey, why you get on this big, awesome ocean-going vessel to look for whales offshore, and then you go right to J-Pod, which we know where they are because of the satellite tag, and they've been spending so much time in the inland waters, and you're really almost going all the way back to Seattle, which is kind of a little bit funny. But then after a few days, they were able to get reports of K&L pod in the Strait of Juan de Fuca, and then they have followed them offshore, and they've also tagged L84 Nissa. And so now they're able to track at least L-Pod. And it's been unclear lately with the reports that's been put up on the Facebook page, on the NOAA West Coast page. They post updates every once in a while, which are kind of fun to read what's going on. And we know that they have a tag on L-Pod and that L-Pod was with K-Pod for a while, but it's been unclear if K-Pod is still hanging out with them. So also in their updates, we're finding that they're spending a lot of time, again, off the Columbia River between Washington and Oregon. They're sort of doing some intermittent feeding is what it sounds like. Long periods of no foraging evidence, and then all of a sudden they do get some foraging evidence and some scat and scale samples here and there. If you want to follow the NOAA research crews, it's pretty fun. You can go on to Ship Tracker and put in the Bell M. Shimada, and you can follow where they are in basically real time offshore. So today I was looking just a few hours ago, and they were off of Tillamook, Oregon, off the coast there, which is just really, really neat to be able to follow exactly what they're doing. Also today, February 23rd, NOAA released their decision to revise critical habitat. So it doesn't mean that right now they've revised anything, but that the decision is warranted and they're going to go back and they're going to do a bunch more research cruises, more acoustic recorders, trying to get more sightings from the public for what's going on offshore. And we can look forward to another announcement in 2017 with some more information of just how they might revise the critical habitat offshore. And some upcoming events. Of course, March 14th, join Whale Scout and Nature Consortium. We are going to be at the West Duwamish Greenbelt. And so all you West Seattle folks, I know there's a lot of whale people out there. Please come out and join us. This land is really important to restore and have it be in tip-top shape because a lot of the water that's running through there is going into the Duwamish River, which we know used to at least be a location where a lot of Chinook salmon came in to spawn. So that's a good food source for our southern resident killer whales. Also, on April 11th, there's the CAF workshop that's hosted by the Whale Museum up in Friday Harbor. Also in Friday Harbor, April 17th, the Salish Sea Association of Marine Naturalists Gear Up. If you are a member or you want to become a member, check out the Whale Museum website and get involved there. It's a really cool workshop to get the latest information on what's happening before the summer months. So you can, as a naturalist, be spewing off all of the latest information. And April 18th, Welcome the Whales. This is an Orca Network event hosted in Langley on Whidbey Island. And it's a really fun event where they do a parade and they have a speaker come in. And it celebrates the gray whales that are returning to Saratoga Passage in the spring months. So I look forward to seeing you all at that. And you can also go online to whalescout.org and check out our event calendar where we have these events posted and many more. And now, without further ado, I would like to welcome Howard Garrett to the podcast. He is with Orca Network, and they have been working for a long time in trying to remove Lolita, a captive killer whale that is at the Miami Seaquarium, and return her to her home waters. We are back here on the Whale Scout podcast, and we are joined by Howard Garrett of Orca Network. And Orca Network, as many of you I'm sure already know, has been working on freeing a captive orca, Lolita, who lives at the Miami Seaquarium. And thank you, Howard, for joining me today.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me.
I want to start off by first asking you a little bit about the history of Lolita in captivity and the southern residents. How many southern residents were captured back in the 60s and 70s for captivity? And as we know, Lolita is the only one that's still alive. And what happened to the others?
Well, we don't really know the exact number because records were not that well kept. And there was some secrecy going on just to avoid either the public recriminations or the regulations. So we're not positive, but around 40 or so were taken by the best estimates and delivered. And another 10 to 13 were killed during the captures over a 10-year period. So all the others were delivered to some, roadside attractions all over the world, Hong Kong, Europe, South America, places you wouldn't imagine. And they all died within a few years. The longest lasting died in 1987, except Lolita, and somehow she's persevered all these years.
And why exactly is captivity bad for killer whales? You know, do you have any hints on why some of them didn't make it?
Well, it's no bed of roses to be in captivity from the killer whale's point of view. You can just kind of imagine. I mean, it's intuitive, but it's also in the statistics and the health records that they just go downhill rapidly. They survive the transport, but the shock of the change, the stresses from you know, being in the wide open spaces in a big extended family and being in communication with your family all the time and with your surroundings and constantly seeking out food or associations or, you know, all the social dynamics and all the foraging behaviors and everything suddenly abruptly end, and you're picked up and taken to a little box, a concrete box, in a very strenuous and stressful transport, and then nothing is familiar and nothing is going on, and there's no relationship, no bonding, no room to move, and no challenge, no food to procure. It's given to you, but conditional on your behavior. So you're being manipulated and dominated, and that initial shock can kill the whales within a few weeks or months. They go downhill. They don't eat. They lose their immune response. And die usually of some infection or pneumonia within a few weeks or months. And if they make it over that, then there is just the chronic stress. And if they have the will, whatever it is, the courage to go on for another few years, eventually that catches up with them and something gets them if they don't actually, in the case of Hugo, for instance, accelerate his own demise by banging his head against the wall.
So can you describe what a day in the life of Lolita is like?
Well, a day in the life of Lolita is routine. It's the same schedule every day. She does 2 20-minute shows per day, one before noon and one afternoon, and it's the same routine. There are usually 4 Pacific white-sided dolphins in the pool with her, and the trainers trot out, and the music is blaring, and they're all dancing and waving back and forth, and one of them has a microphone and does the spiel about how the only place in the world where you'll see orcas and dolphins together, they're normally, predator and prey in the wild. Of course, that's not true of Lolita. She's a fish eater. But they have their standard routine, and part of that is to call her over and have her open her mouth wide and make this shrieking, shrill call. Not a call, just a siren sound, to a signal, and then she gets a fish, and then, you know, does, I don't know, a dozen or so different routines, and then the music ends, everybody files out, and she's sitting there with her dolphins, and that's it.
I've always wondered, you know, they take these killer whales out of the wild from a variety of different places in the world. They eat very different things, but it seems like once they get to captivity, they feed them something that's like a small silvery fish. You know, what exactly do they eat, and how do they, you know, get a salmon eater like Lolita to start eating these other fish?
Right. That is part of the shock at first. In the beginning is to accommodate a different diet or a different mix of diets. I don't think anybody knew what they ate back in 1970 when she was captured, so I'm not sure what they gave her, but I've heard reports more recently that it's a mix. It's about 10% salmon chopped up a certain way, and some smelt and some herring and maybe some other small fish. But they freeze them and bring them out in an ice bucket and just, you know, toss them into her mouth after she performs the routines.
And when exactly did you get involved with the effort to remove Lolita from captivity? How did it get started?
Well, it was kind of an interesting chain of events, because in the beginning I was just working with the research as an assistant, going out, taking photos, doing the data entry and whatever tasks came up. And then in 1993, it was when the movie Free Willy was about to be released, the producers of the movie, Lauren and Schuler Donner, who live on Orcas Island, knew of Ken's work and got the word to him that Keiko needed help, that he was dying in that pool and everybody knew it, and they had just fallen in love with him. Everybody had, all the crew, and so they wanted to help him find a better home. They didn't know what that would be, but Ken looked it up. He did the research. He spent the entire summer of 93 going through every record he could find of any release effort of any whale or dolphin and all the bibliographic references and veterinary records and everything he could find that could inform him about whether it was possible to put a long-term captive orca back into the ocean. And he figured out, well, yeah, you could do that, that they're really quite robust. If they can survive being in captivity, they can survive the transport back to the ocean, and they'll probably thrive. And so he got involved and actually went down to Mexico with Naomi Rose and Ben White and a couple of others and got the permission of the owners of Keiko in Mexico to devise a plan to put Keiko back in the ocean. So he got to work on that, but he, Ken, informed SeaWorld right away that he was doing that because he wanted to work with them. He wanted to collaborate, and he wanted to do the upright thing, and they took that as a giant shot across the bow and sent the Shamu jet to Mexico and started pretty well strong-arming the park down there to not work with Ken, and that they would take over and they would take care of Keiko, which they never did, but they successfully bumped Ken out of that project. So by 1994, we realized that we're not going to be involved in the Keiko project, but we've done the research and we have a better whale, a better candidate for release anyway. So we turned our attention to Lolita, and it happened that the governor of the state was coming up to San Juan Island to do a town forum. And so Ken talked to him and said, could you help sort of generate some publicity for bringing Lolita back? And of course, Ralph Monroe was Secretary of State, and he jumped right into it, too. And so the three of them announced the campaign in March of 1995. And that got me involved because I'd been helping Ken all this time. But, of course, they all had day jobs and a lot of work to do, and there really was no campaign. So I went ahead and started the campaign with everyone's blessings and got a nonprofit organization going, and that was pretty well how it started.
And just a few days ago at the American Cetacean Society meeting, you mentioned briefly that you also lived in Florida for a few years working on this project. What exactly did you do down there?
Well, right. The Progressive Animal Welfare Society in Lynwood sponsored 6 months of going to Miami to just generate publicity there. And that was a tough row to hoe because there's a lot of resistance there. This aquarium is a mainstay of the tourist economy of South Florida. The owners are very civic-minded. They're involved in everything from Orange Bowl to the Humane Society and all the stranding networks. And so everybody is pretty much on their side. And so it was hard to find very many people that would help out with the Lolita campaign. So I was there for 2 years and treaded water for a lot of that time, but did do some of the first demonstrations right there at the gates of the Seaquarium and had some allies and did some benefit events and got a few things going, but nothing that really impacted the Seaquarium and got them to come to the table and talk about it. So I came back in 1999 and moved to Whidbey Island.
And now bringing us up to the present, just a few weeks ago, NOAA released their determination that Lolita is now a member of the endangered southern resident killer whales. In the past, she had been excluded. Now NOAA says she is included. She is endangered. And this is one step in a series of lawsuits that you and other groups are working on to remove Lolita from the Miami Seaquarium. And so can you tell us now what your next steps are and how this all works?
Right. Well, it's really getting interesting. You know, after being in the doldrums and getting really no traction, no movement for all these years, suddenly, and it really was the trigger of the death of the trainer in Orlando in 2010, that got the attorneys working on a strategy, and they put together this sort of multi-pronged strategy that involved, for one thing, getting her listed as endangered, included as a member of her family under the ESA, but also challenging the USDA, which under the Animal, Plant, and Health Inspection Service, APHIS, has regulatory power over marine mammals in captivity. And the whale tank violates three provisions of the Animal Welfare Act. So they sued the USDA, and that is currently still pending and will be heard in March 2028. So we're looking forward to seeing that be heard and determined. And that establishes that she is being harmed there. If we win that case, it will show in court, demonstrated line by line, that the provisions of the Animal Welfare Act are being violated, and that constitutes harm, which then fits the description under the ESA of a prohibited take, as it's called. So that would reinforce the ruling that she should not be allowed to stay in that tank because it is causing her harm. And at the same time, there's a couple of other prongs at work. One did not involve the Seaquarium or Lolita, but it was in 2012, which was to sue SeaWorld for slavery, for enslaving five of their wild-caught orcas. That didn't win in court, but it certainly brought that issue up and sort of got a lot of people in the public thinking about, yeah, it is kind of like slavery to put an orca in captivity. And then there was yet another prong, a sort of a fourth line of attack, and that was to call on OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to come down on the Seaquarium in the same way that they had on SeaWorld after the trainer was killed, for endangering their employees by having them get in the water with the orcas. And OSHA agreed that the Seaquarium is in the same category. Lolita potentially, although I've never known of her to really attack anybody, but potentially she could. So they did enforce those regulations. The Seaquarium appealed that enforcement. That was in July. So that case will be heard now in August in a very high-profile public hearing that will involve disclosure of probably 35 years of the records from the Seaquarium that will become public. So, you know, all of this just generates one story after another that goes out into the media and throughout the public and raises awareness and knowledge and changes attitudes. And it is that sort of tidal wave of changing public attitudes that is really driving all of these processes and the decisions in the courts and in the agencies and the public's attendance records at these places and the revenues at the park. People are just not going into SeaWorld recently, and I believe the same is true of the Seaquarium, because they're becoming aware of the conditions from the whale's point of view.
Yeah, and the public opinion is, I think, extremely important in a lot of environmental decisions. And So I believe that with the blackfish effect and all these different things that are happening, that more and more people are becoming aware of these issues. And sometimes I like to go online and read comments on news articles and sort of read what people say. You know, you hear people say, you know, free Lolita and all these different things in support of what you're doing. And of course, there always are a few people that don't agree with you. And some people saying things like, you know, Lolita's lived for so long in the Miami Seaquarium, and she's doing pretty well. She seems pretty healthy. You know, what would you say to someone that might believe that she's actually better off in captivity?
Right. Well, to me, this is where it really gets interesting. It's that challenge to answer that kind of question, because it really calls for an understanding of orca natural history, not just wildlife natural history, not just biology, but orcas in particular are very resilient, very retain long memories, and their social bonds are the most important part of their lives, the most important aspects of their lives. And so it really is necessary to explain the sort of extraordinary capabilities of orcas for people to understand that even after decades in captivity, that's not lost, that memory is still there, that knowledge of who they are, because they really are persons within their family. They are members in good standing. There's every reason to believe that they are self-aware, meaning self-aware of their circumstances, their social situation, their family ties. Everything about them stays with them throughout their entire lives. And of course, their memory capacity with their brains that are four times the size of human brains does need to be pointed out as a giant hard drive storage capacity that will keep those memories fresh and alive, as long as they can keep their spirits up, as long as their health can stay in good shape and their mental attitude can stay active and resilient. And, you know, some orcas and certainly dolphins, sometimes after decades of harsh dominations in captivity, they apparently, some can lose that ability to rebound, but she hasn't. I mean, it's clear in her behavior that it's all still very fresh for her. So you need to point all these things out, and that's the educational process that is an essential part of this whole campaign.
And so if these lawsuits and different legal battles all work in your favor and everything sort of aligns and falls into place, your plan is to bring Lolita and retire her in a sea pen somewhere in the San Juan Islands and work towards reintroduction if possible. And you gave us a little bit of a teaser at the ACS meeting saying that this is sort of a unique opportunity and that there's a location that is also at the site of a Chinook salmon hatchery. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that might help all of our southern resident killer whales?
Right. Well, this is the agreement we have with the owner, the understanding that we have of the property, who operates a Chinook hatchery, but not just any Chinook hatchery. This is a very unique operation where there were no Chinook, no salmon at all, but he built some ponds where there's a natural spring, some ponds and a hatchery operation, and began with some salmon from somewhere else, from Hood Canal back in the mid-80s, and raised some and released them there, and a small number came back in the first few years, and there were some pretty sparse years. But in recent years, about 1,500 full-size Chinook have come back every year, which is a pretty good return. And the whole idea of having Lolita there appeals to him because it's a way for him to tell people about his model, his successful experimental model in growing Chinook where there never were any before. And that can be replicated up and down the coast from Southeast Alaska to California in so many different locations. And the accumulative effect of doing that in so many different places, I mean, it's self-sustaining, you know, because the Chinook come back. The ones that make it through the orcas and all the other fishing that's going on out there. So it's not a high-cost kind of operation, but it's a high-return operation. I mean, what kind of a gift is that, that you can just bring eggs and you know, fertilized eggs and grow Chinook and with in just natural circumstances, just, you know, dig a few ponds and care for them a little bit. You do broadcast a little bit of fish meal, but you don't have to build a huge expensive structure about it or, you know, any expensive facility, and they return. So, I mean, it really is just a novel idea that needs some publicity. And Lolita can be the media magnet that will draw people to that experiment. And as we're describing Lolita, we'll describe this whole operation and help to get the word out and get it started elsewhere. And the overall effect of dozens of such operations would have a real improvement in the fortunes of the southern residents. There'd be a whole lot more Chinook out there for them.
And I'm just curious, I have to ask, have they noticed that possibly the southern residents have come by the site when the salmon are returning? Have they noticed that?
They're looking for it, and they haven't seen it, but there was a case in recent months. In fact, it was just before J50 was discovered, the newborn discovered at the end of December. J27's tag showed that he was right in there, very close to this Chinook hatchery, which is Lolita's retirement center, in the middle of the night. Spent a couple of hours very nearby. So that was a very interesting little coincidence. I'm not sure what it means, but it was great to see.
And would these salmon provide a bit of like a training tool for Lolita to maybe learn how to catch live salmon again?
Oh, that's part of it. Yeah. Yeah, they'd be available to her, not year-round, so it depends on the timing, but in the fall, yeah, sure, she would have a first dibs on them. She'd be able to pick them out before they go up the ladder, so absolutely. That's part of the plan.
Well, it's very interesting and gives you a lot to think about the connection between southern resident killer whales, now including Lolita and Chinook salmon. What can people do to get involved or to help in your efforts?
Well, you know, the name of the game is public attitudes, public awareness and knowledge, and so it's really hard to say exactly what people can do because it depends on their contacts and their abilities and their willingness to spread the word, to tell people. And it might be their local media, it might be their family, it might be their class, their teacher. Wherever they happen to be, it's a pretty interesting topic, and so it's not hard to bring up. And you can explain a whole lot to people. And, you know, most people don't really know much about it, or if they know a little bit, there's always more to talk about. So I would say just, you know, talk about it. Social media, you know, blogs, articles, any comments in, you know, articles and newspapers, any way they can think of. And there are, you know, some public demonstrations and events and things going on now and then. So just keep tuned, watch Orca Network and Whale Scout and many other, you know, available outlets for information and see what's going on and keep up with it and join in on it.
Well, Howard, I have to thank you so much for coming on our podcast today. And I encourage everyone out there, go up and visit orcanetwork.org. Get on their email list and stay connected. You can also look at some of the plans, the detailed plans for Lolita's retirement up on the Orca Network website as well. Thank you so much, Howard. And I look forward to talking to you in the future as things develop.
Thank you, Whitney. I appreciate the call.
And up next, we have Anna Gullickson, and she is a float plane pilot working for Kenmore Air. And she was so inspired by killer whales and other whales that she sees flying her passengers all around the Pacific Northwest that she worked to initiate a bill banning cetaceans in captivity in Washington state. Welcome back to the Whale Scout Podcast. We are joined by Anna Gullickson, and welcome, Anna. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Whitney, for having me on.
You are very welcome. So for those who may not know you, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in killer whales?
Yes, for sure. I am a float plane pilot for Kenmore Air here in Seattle, and I decided I wanted to fly float planes when I was just about 5 years old. My aunt lives up in the Gulf Islands, and that's when I saw my first Beaver airplane on floats taxiing in to the island. That's how a lot of people travel up here in the Northwest. And when I saw the airplane, I just knew that's what I wanted to do. So I went to school and knew that Kenmore Air was, you know, one of the biggest float plane companies in the U.S. and up here in Seattle. And so I worked on to get on with them, which has led me to, I've been flying for Kenmore for the last 7 going on 8 years now. And every day flying in the summer, we see whales pretty much every day, from grays to humpbacks to our southern resident killer whales and transient killer whales as well. Sometimes even 2 to 3 times a day, we'll be lucky enough to see them as we're flying over and flying people all over the Pacific Northwest. So when you see them that often and they become part of your daily livelihood and they just become a part of your life, and it's hard not to care about them and want to create the best environment for them.
So when you're flying, these float planes are flying low enough where you can get a pretty good idea of what's going on around you in the water?
We can, yes. We fly at least 500 feet minimum over the water. And then we have a company policy that if we do see whales, we go up to at least 1,000 feet minimum, and we pull back our power so it's quieter for the whales, so we're as little disruption as possible for them. And we do circle once in a while so passengers can get a nice look at them from above, because you don't get that view very often. But we limit to only one circle, just so we're not bothering the whales at all with our noise or pestering them from above.
That's really cool. And, you know, to think about it, so many people have the experience of watching whales from the side, and you have all this experience of watching them from a bird's eye view. Was it kind of tricky to learn, especially between like gray whales and humpbacks, sort of how to identify different species from that point of view?
It is, for sure. And it's very interesting, but you can see so much. Even from 1,000 feet, you're quite close to the water, it seems, and the animals are so large, and so you can definitely tell how many of them are traveling together, especially with the orca whales or the southern resident whales. You can see sometimes up to 20 of them, you know, swimming in a line, and they're black and white spots from above, and you can see them underwater, you know, swimming through the seaweed and having it rub on their backs. And I've seen a humpback off of Smith Island up in the Straits of Juan de Fuca, and he was just breaching and flapping his flippers all around, and you get to see some pretty incredible things that a lot of people aren't able to see.
That sounds
local, that's for sure.
Absolutely amazing. I've still never been up in a float plane, but I'm going to have to do it sometime, because it just sounds incredible.
Yes, you will have to come for sure.
And so now,
I like it.
Where did you get the idea to start this bill, which would effectively ban captivity in Washington state?
So last year I was hearing about the California bill, AB 2140, that essentially would do the same thing in the state of California. And it's obviously more difficult down there because there are captive stations in California. But they need a lot of support for the bill, and it was kind of a big deal that they were trying to ban it down there for all the orcas at SeaWorld. And the California bill is strictly for orca whales, where the one in Washington is for cetaceans, which would be all whales, such as orcas, dolphins, porpoises. And so I went down to the hearing to give support for it just because, you know, I felt pretty strongly about it. And we went down to the hearing, and it was amazing how many people there that were in support of it and wanted it to happen. And I came back and I just started thinking about what I could do in Washington State and how, you know, we could help, and with, you know, the whales up here in the Northwest, and what a big part of our culture, I guess, it is up here. I figured that, well, why can't we ban captivity in our state? And we don't even have any captive cetaceans in our state. So I thought that would make it even easier. So that's what gave me the ideas going down there to that hearing and wanting to do it in our state.
And what were some of your first steps in getting it going? You know, how does one person start something like this?
That's a good question. I don't know anything about politics, so I thought the same thing. I had the idea, and then like, okay, so now what? So I approached a couple other whale people and talked to Dr. Naomi Rose, who actually helped with the California bill, and Dr. Giles, who is a scientist, and she studies the southern resident whales up here off of San Juan Island and works with Tucker, the whale poo sniffing dog. And the two of them helped me get started on just kind of how we wanted to do it, what we would want to do, if it would be possible, how I would go about doing it. So they helped me kick it off and get started not quite a year ago, but almost a year ago. And then I fly Senator Rinker up to, he lives up on in the San Juan Islands, and so I've flown him quite a bit, and so I know him. And I thought he would be, he's very involved in our waters and the oceans and animals, and so I thought he would be a perfect candidate for a bill like this. And so one day at Kenmore, I was supposed to fly him, and we had a weather day and had some time to hang around since we weren't able to fly because of the fog. And I looked up at him and said, Senator Rinker, I have something that I think you might be interested in. And he said, what is that? I said, well, I would like you to propose a bill banning cetacean captivity in the state. And he said, I think that's a great idea. And he immediately started calling people, and that's kind of where it all began.
Wow, that is a amazing story. And what I've heard is that he's been getting so much positive feedback about proposing this bill.
He has been, yes. From what I've heard, I've seen some newspaper articles and TV interviews and radio interviews, and he said he was getting tweets from little children in Africa that were thanking him for doing this, and it's pretty incredible how far it spreads and how many people are passionate about it.
And I was out of town for the first hearing, but I watched it on the computer. You can go online and sort of get the feed from Olympia. And there was a young girl that testified. I think she was from Bainbridge Island. And it was powerful to me to watch her get up there in front of everyone and speak about the killer whales. How important are kids like this and the public in determining the outcome of the bill?
They're very important. Yes, as little Grace from Bainbridge Island, and it's just so neat to have little kids that are, one, involved in all of these topics and care about the environment and know that these things are going on and want to be a part of, you know, their future. And it's great to have them involved, and it's great. They're setting the precedent for the future and what happens with our environment and with these animals. And so if they're involved and they're setting the trend for what will be acceptable in the future and what will be tolerated, then that's, you know, that's what's going to stand, and that's what's going to make the difference ultimately. So it's a big, and then just public pressure in general, just having people involved and contacting their local representatives and things like that, and just letting people know that they do care about this issue and they, you know, will make a stand and make sure that it's not acceptable.
What I found sort of unique about this bill in Washington State was that we have so many opportunities to see whales, either from shore or on a boat or from a plane. And so, and I know some of these comments were made at the hearing that it just makes sense to not put whales in captivity in our state just because of the fact that we can see them in the wild. So I thought that was really interesting. Can you give us an update on what's happening now with the bill in Olympia?
So the bill in Olympia is now in the House of Representatives, and it's in what's called the Rules Committee. And so somebody out of that committee will hopefully pull the bill out of rules, and then it would be put onto the House floor and be voted on there by all the House of Representatives. And that will happen hopefully before March 11th, I believe is the cutoff for that. And then if it passes through the House, if both of those things happen and it's successful, then it will go over to the Senate and it will go through the Parks and Recreation Committee in the Senate and then basically through the same process into rules and then to the Senate floor. And if it passes through all of those stages, then it will go to the governor's desk. And if he signs it, then it would be law. So it has quite a few steps to make, but it's going well so far.
And if people want to help out, what can they do to get involved?
It'd be great if people could just call their local representatives and let them know that they support this bill and they urge them to keep it moving forward. The bill is HB 2115, and I do have a website here if I can give that to you that's easy for people to find their local representative, and an email or a phone call or even a letter is all great. The web address is app.leg.wa.gov with a /district finder is one word. So that it's a very easy way. You just put in your address and they'll tell you who your local representative is.
That is a really handy tool, and I will be sure to put that up on the Whale Scout website as well so you can link to that.
Sure.
Now, bringing this toward like the larger picture of captivity issues, you know, why Washington State, and are there other states that you believe will be next in banning captivity? And do you think that the success in Washington State and other states would finally push states like California and Florida that do have whales in captivity?
I think definitely as more states do it, I think, you know, that would put some pressure on it. But we would not be the first state, actually. North Carolina, as well as New York, has already banned. North Carolina is, it's North or South Carolina, has banned cetaceans, I believe. And then, New York banned orcas in captivity. So we're not the first on the list, but we're definitely in the beginning stages. And I just think it's really important for Washington as a state because they are, such a big part of our culture here in the Pacific Northwest. And the orca whale is our state mammal, so that just proves how much they mean to us and how many cetaceans we do have in our waters that a lot of people around Washington do a lot to protect all of these whales, as you know, with Whale Scout, and especially our southern resident killer whales because they are endangered. So I think we have an extra responsibility to protect these whales, and as we have found out through the years that cetaceans do not thrive in captivity just because of how large they are just as an animal, and the space they need. They can swim up to 100 miles a day, so they need a lot of area where they can swim, and their social complexity of being with the rest of the members of their pods or being with other whales and how important that is to them, and captivity just doesn't allow these things and therefore doesn't give them the life that they deserve, and they're unable to thrive. And I think it's important for Washington State to show that we realize that and we respect our whales and our waters and to continue supporting that.
Well, Anna, I want to thank you so much for coming on the Whale Scout podcast today. You are truly very inspiring, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Whitney. It was great to talk to you, and I appreciate all that you do as well, for sure.
Thank you. I would like to thank all of you for tuning in today for the Whale Scout podcast. And I also want to give you a reminder, if you love these podcasts, I recommend you go onto iTunes and hit subscribe. And that way, anytime we post a new podcast, it'll go directly to your phone. You'll get a little notification and you can just tune in at the gym or in your car and stay up to date with all the latest news and information. Also, we just recently launched a new Whale Scout website. So if you've been up there before and you were ever confused, you couldn't find something, you've got to check it out now. It is awesome. We've put in a lot of work, and it's becoming a really great resource for people. And so do check that out. And while you're there, you will see our donate button. If you like what you're hearing and like what we're doing, please consider donating. We are a 501c3 public charity, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you again very soon. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.